Ernest Albert Andrews, Jr., otherwise known as Andy, died in 2016. He was 92 years old, so he lived a pretty good long life. He was living in a tiny mountain town, the mountain town of Montreat, North Carolina. Very small population, and yet around 700 people came to his funeral to pay their respects to him. He was born on July 27, 1923, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, the fourth of six children. Came from a rather humble background. His memoir came out late last summer. And that's what the article I read yesterday was about. David Hunt spent 15 years working with Andy to assemble the material for the book. In the first part of his memoir, he really details Andy's devout Christian upbringing and his commitment to preserve his faith and his humanity, even as he went through the horrors of war and the brutalization of World War II. You see, at the age of 20, he was among the third wave of troops to land on Omaha Beach on D-Day. And he went on to fight in several other key battles as World War II began to come to a close. And he did so as an Army machine gunner. Now, I don't know much about Army machine gunners, but what this article said was their life expectancy in combat was about 7 minutes. That was the average lifespan for a machine gunner. And yet somehow he survived. He survived multiple battles. In fact, he was awarded 4 Purple Hearts, 4 Bronze Stars. He had several close calls, including one in which his glasses were shot off his face. Now, despite all the horrors that he witnessed, he remained at least some belief, maintained a belief in human dignity. He once was given a direct order, which he disobeyed. He was told to gun down 10 Germans who waved a white flag of surrender. Another instance, in a battle to hold a hill, he was among a handful of survivors of a German attack, though he himself was wounded. And when the battle ended, a white handkerchief appeared in the hands of a wounded German. And as the German walked up to him, he pleaded in broken English to be able to surrender. And Andy explained to him that he would not kill anyone who was surrendering because of his Christianity. He felt that was totally wrong for him to do. And the 17-year-old German that was talking to him said, "I, Christian, too," in his broken English. And the two of them hobbled off together to the nearest aid station. He rationalized that killing other humans when they were trying to kill him was okay, but he drew the line at somebody who was surrendering. He at least maintained that in his thinking. Now, I don't want to glamorize war in any way. The article I read about Andy contains a number of incidents that I won't convey. They're too horrible to read in my mind. But it ended by talking about how for the rest of his life, Andy had the desire that his willingness to talk about the horrors that he experienced in war, a terrible suffering and the outright horrors that inevitably accompany all wars, would perhaps cause the repetition of history to not happen. Now, of course, that was posted yesterday on Veterans Day, and sadly, mankind has not been able to stop wars. They've not found a way to do that. Paul quoted the book of Psalms in Romans chapter 3. I'm going to turn there. Romans chapter 3. This comes from the book of Psalms. Romans 3, beginning in verse 9. My margin says this comes from several psalms, but beginning of verse 9, he says, "What then? Are we any better than they? Not at all, for we previously charged that both Jews and Greeks," meaning non-Jews, the rest of the world, "that they're all under sin. As it is written," and here's the quote from Psalms, "there is none righteous, no, not one. There's none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. They've all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is no one who does good, no, not one. Their throat is an open tomb. Their tongues, with their tongues, they practice deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. The way of peace they have not known. Now, again, that's a quote from the Old Testament from the book of Psalms. Psalms mentions that. Mankind doesn't know the way to peace. Unfortunately, there are very few years in human history that have not had some kind of war. And of course, when we think of peace, we normally think about nations going to war, that it has to be a nation that's they're fighting each other. And of course, that involves governments. So it's the governments that typically start the war. Somebody in that government decides they need to go to war against some other nation. You know, we're still in the midst of a national election for Congress and our government. Numerous sources estimate the total spending of federal and state elections this year is going to be around $17 billion with a B, dollars. That just astounds me that that much money has been spent. And, of course, a couple of states are still counting, and there's at least one runoff, so that means there's going to be more spending. How many more millions or billions are going to go into it? Now, I'm kind of sick and tired of all the hype and the attack ads, and I was hoping that when we got back from the camp conference Tuesday night, that maybe Wednesday, Thursday, maybe this week sometime, it'll all be over. Probably a lot of you are like me, ready for it to be finished and be done. But it looks like it's going to drag on some more. I'd like to take a look today at some of the reasons that humans just can't seem to stop fighting. Why we can't seem to find an answer to war. From God's perspective. And you know, I always think when I start thinking about governments and the issues with government, about a quote from President Reagan. He is quoted as saying, "Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem." And I'm kind of thinking, so often doesn't that tend to ring true in our ears? So some humans seem to agree with God that it's governments that are a major problem. You know, I think it's very instructive to take note of the first things in the Bible. So I'd like to take a look at the first war, the battle, or first war that the Bible records for us. It's found in the book of Ezekiel. Many of you probably already know where I'm turning. That's Ezekiel 28. This is really the first battle, the first war that ever took place, as far as we can tell from the biblical record. I'm going to start chapter 28 in verse 12. It says, "Son of man, take a lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the Lord God." So these are direct words from God that Ezekiel was supposed to convey. Now, who is this king of Tyre? Well, let's read a little bit. He says, "You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God." So we get to a point already, we think, wait a minute, this is not talking about a normal human being. This is somebody who was in Eden. This is some being that was there in the garden. "Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, topaz, diamond," and begins to list all of those. Verse 14, he says, "You were the anointed cherub who covers." Oh, so now we're talking about something that is angelic. Cherubim are described in the Bible. Cherubs are described as one of the types of angels who apparently oversees other angels. There are three of them mentioned in the Bible, and this is one of them. And perhaps each of them had a third of the angels that they govern or manage, which means this individual was a part of government. Actually, part of the government of God, but overseeing certain responsibilities. Moses was told to make the mercy seat on top of the ark, and there were to be two cherubs with wings that covered that mercy seat. It seems to be an image of what was taking place, or what does take place, in heaven. It goes on to say, "You were on the holy mountain of God." Now, we know God often uses mountain as a symbol of government. We find that many places in the various prophetic books. It represents a government or a kingdom. So again, he's involved, this being is involved in God's government. You walk back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. And here's another clue. This is not a human being. This is some spirit being that we're talking about, a cherub. Now, I think most of us realize that this is talking about Lucifer, the one who became Satan. And I think sometimes it's good for us to go back and review. Why do we say that? Why are we convinced of that? Well, we just looked at a number of things that can't apply to any human being. And specifically, we're told that this individual was a cherub. Continuing in verse 15, you were perfect in the ways, in your ways, from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. So it was a created being. The only two beings we know of that were never created were God and the Logos, the one who became Jesus Christ, the spokesman. We're told he came and lived in the flesh, and he called the other God being Father. So we had the Father and the Son ever since that time, ever since he came and lived on earth. They're the only two that have existed for eternity. And iniquity was found in him. Verse 16, by the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. So sin was found in this cherub, who was filled with violence, and that made him profane. And so God cast him out, destroyed him, or put him down. Hebrew words sometimes are not specific the way our English words are specific and can mean got rid of him or removed him from his government position, not totally destroyed because we know he continued to exist. And destroyed you, a covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart, verse 17, that's very instructive, isn't it? Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. And when you look at various lexicons, they tell you that Hebrew word means lofty, it means elevated, and that it can mean having a higher opinion of yourself than you should. It's pride, it's vanity. This is obviously what was the issue. This was the sin that led to the action that took place by this spirit being. That sin corrupted, in verse 17, he goes on to say, you corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they may gaze at you. Now, again, pride, being haughty, being arrogant, we get the picture that pride was the big issue here. It was the root of his sin. The Bible continuously, or many places, warns us against the dangers of pride. Being laid before kings, that seems a little confusing to some, but the Hebrew word just means before sovereigns. Again, whether you're a spirit who's a sovereign or a human being, it's the same Hebrew word for a sovereign or a ruler or somebody who's governing. So Lucifer was cast down before them. They saw him. They gazed at him. Doesn't mean it has to be human monarchs, human beings. Let's go to the companion passage in Isaiah 14, because there we get a more specific detail of what he did. Verses 12 through 14, I'll make this one much quicker. Verse 12, Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. Here we have the name being given. We give additional information. His name means light bearer, shining one, morning star, many ways to translate that. How you're fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you're cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations. For you said, and you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. Again, not a human being, this is a spirit being. I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. So he wanted to take God's position. And of course, he was cast down. He didn't knock God off his throne. He lost that battle. He lost that war. And of course, how in the world could he think he would win it? How could he think he would be able to win against the being that created him, who's obviously far superior to him? When we think about that, it's like the logic. It's just twisted. How in the world could he ever think, even with a third of the angels, that he could overpower God and the other two-thirds of the angels? So what was involved in this? Well, obviously, when we analyze what he wanted, coveting was involved. It breaks one of the commandments of God, doesn't it? He wanted something. He wanted something that wasn't his. Greed was involved. Then attempted to steal it. Wanted to take something that wasn't his, God's throne. That was all part of that first war. As short as it probably was, I have no idea how long it took. Time is irrelevant in the spirit realm. But I would imagine it was a rather short battle, a rather short war. I would submit to you that all wars since that one have involved essentially the same issues. Some government or some leader with pride or greed or coveting or all three attempts to take something by force from someone else or from some other nation. Usually it's territory, whether it's just for the space, the living space, or whether it's for resources that they want. But you know, sometimes wars are also started out of desire for power and prestige. It's not always just about territory. Those thoughts, those attitudes, those actions obviously go against God's eternal principles for life, which are embodied in the Ten Commandments. Those principles, they infect leaders in government just like they infect normal human beings. But they're involved in what brings about war. So this is the first war. This is the first battle that we read of. And I think much of what we learn from this one is what we can see in wars that human beings are experiencing and have experienced. After God cleaned up the mess of Satan's rebellion, at least the mess on this planet, we read that in Genesis 1, where he remade, reformed, cleaned up this planet, made it habitable, and created human beings. Doesn't seem like it took very long for Satan to infect mankind with those terrible precursors for war, does it? We're not told how long it was, but it seems like there was some pride involved in Eve wanting to be wise like God. There was some greed involved in wanting to take what didn't belong to her, the fruit of the tree that God said was off limits. And of course, Adam joined in. He ate too. He was complicit in it. He's not without his sin. And the sad consequences of their sin led to them being kicked out of paradise. Ended up the ground was cursed. Now he had to work hard to get it to produce the food that he wanted. And women were going to have difficulty bringing forth children. And what happened after that? Well, when the first two children were grown, Cain and Abel, Abel brought a sacrifice that God accepted. Cain's was not. Cain was angry. Why did he go to war? Why did he go to battle? Why did he kill his brother? We can surmise that he wanted to be accepted too. His pride was hurt. His prestige was hurt. So he took the life of the one whose offering was accepted. He, in essence, went to war to eliminate the competition. Isn't that kind of the way mankind thinks often? And the way nations sometimes think? Well, let's eliminate the competition. Let's get rid of them. Sometimes in the business world, you see that, don't you? If somebody's above you, you just cut the legs out from under them and they go down, and that automatically makes you higher, makes you go up. It's a sad way to think of things, but that's the carnal approach that copies Satan's approach. Because in essence, wasn't that what he was trying to do to God? He wanted to take God's throne, make God subservient to him. Satan even asked Jesus to bow down and worship him. You know, I don't know if I've ever really made that exact connection, but it sure seems to fit when we think about war and the reasons for war. And in chapter 6 of Genesis, we read that things got very bad within generations. Genesis chapter 6, with those attitudes infused into mankind's thinking, it didn't take long and God had this to say about mankind. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5, Genesis 6, 5. Says, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. He was grieved when he saw mankind following the way that Lucifer had gone, the way of breaking the intent of God's law, the way of going the opposite of what God was wanting people to go, the way of war, the way of fighting, instead of the way of peace. You know, years ago, Mr. Armstrong used to talk about the give way of life and get way of life. I think we can also say there are two ways of life: battling, fighting, and peace. God's way is peace. Mankind is following Satan in a way of fighting and war. Two very different approaches to life. Within generations, the population of this planet went from peaceful and idyllic in the Garden of Eden to a place where God said, "I'm sorry I made man. Look what they have become. Look what Satan has caused them to become. Filled with violence, corruption, and suffering." And of course, then came the flood, and God started all over again with humanity. And within a few chapters, they're once again disobeying God. God said, "Spread out, cover the earth." And so they gather together in a city and say, "We're going to build a tower high enough where God can't drown us all." Again, this rebellion against God. "I don't want to do what God says. I want to do it my way." God delayed things by confusing the language. But you know, that way of thinking that leads to conflict and leads to war was still there. Maybe in different languages, but it was still there. Constantly reinforced by Satan. Let's go to the New Testament, Ephesians chapter 2. Paul describes that influence in Ephesians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. There's that constant influence of Satan in the world today. And that influence is there that we can tune into as well if we're not careful. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1. Paul is writing to Christians. He's writing to those members of the church. And he says, "And you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience." Again, we have one way of life. We have another way of life. We have the way of fighting and war that leads to death. We have the way of peace that leads to life, he says. You were dead in trespasses and sins. Now you're walking a different way. There's some very important concepts here. That spirit, the end of verse 2, who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. Very, very important concepts here. Several of them. The way of thinking that Satan followed, which led to war with God, ends in death for human beings. Now, for Satan, he's spirit. Spirit doesn't grow old and die like we human beings. They don't do that. They don't grow old and die. We do as human beings. So if we choose this way, that way that Satan chose, if we don't ever turn from that and begin thinking like God, that ends in death. God talks about the lake of fire as just burning people up, their ashes. That's it. They cease to exist because they've not been willing to learn the way of peace, the way to peace. Second important concept I think we learn here is that it says Satan works, the spirit that works in the sons of disobedience. He works to inject his way of thinking into human beings. And Paul phrases it that way. He's a spirit that works on the sons of disobedience. He's not passive. He's active. In our world today, many people like to think of him as, well, you know, he's not really real. He's just kind of a figment of an imagination, or he's just kind of a personification of evil. That's not the way Paul saw it. That's not the way God inspired Paul to write it. He inspired Paul to write, Satan works. He is active. He is actively trying to influence people. And his influence, as he mentions in verse 3, urges us to seek to pamper our lusts and desires of the flesh and our mind. The wrong way of thinking. He actively pushes that. Those who don't resist can be influenced by him to, by nature, become what he is: wrathful, angry, destructive. In other words, warlike. And that's our responsibility, to not allow ourselves to get into that frame of mind. Kind of piggybacking off the sermonette here, it seems. Don't get in that frame of mind of retaliation, of getting things escalated. Revelation chapter 12 tells us something very important about Satan. Revelation chapter 12, there are many other places. I won't spend time going to all of them, but Revelation chapter 12, verses 3 and 4, talk about a dragon who had a third of the stars of heaven. His tail drew them. The book of Revelation clearly tells us that when it's speaking of stars, it's speaking about angels. So a third of the angels followed him. He took a third of the angels with him. Let's just jump down to verse 7. As the book of Revelation talks about things that are going to happen before Christ's return, some see it as just an allegory. We see this as literal, that John was given this information because Jesus said, I want to show you things to come, that this is future. In verse 7, Revelation 12, verse 7, and war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they, that is the dragon and his angels, did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. In the book of Job, we read that Satan appeared before God, and God allowed him to appear. Well, have you seen my servant Job? So there was an interaction that he was able at this point to go back and forth to heaven. At this point, when this war takes place, it's another war, not the one that occurred before human beings existed. And there's no place found for them in heaven any longer. He's shut out from heaven, not allowed to go anymore. So this is a second time that Satan gets it in his head that he can overthrow God. And he fights against Michael and Michael's angels, and he again fails. Verse 9 says, so the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So prophecy tells us that at the time of the end, Satan will again fight against God. He will again try to win in a war. But verse 9 says he deceives, and that is the Greek. I don't claim to know a lot about Greek, but I can read interlinears and look at the tenses of the verbs, and that's the present active tense. It's present active tense, deceives. Not past tense with a D on the end, it's S on the end, which means it's present, it's ongoing. Just like in Ephesians 2, I didn't bother to mention that, but there it says he works, same thing, present active tense. He is actively working to deceive and actively working to convince people. So he's trying to deceive. You know, that's why all human governments are unable to bring about the peace that this world so desperately needs and longs for. It's because human governments are made up of humans, right? And that's the problem. Human governments are made up of humans. They're human beings who Satan is actively trying to convince to act his way of life. I was kind of trying to think, okay, well, how many different types of government are there? And I found a website that said, well, you can basically say 10 different types of human government. Democracy, communism, socialism, oligarchy, aristocracy, monarchy, colonialism, totalitarianism, military dictatorship. You probably can think of countries that all of those fit in. And then they mention theocracy as a tenth kind of government. By the way, they describe theocracy as a situation where religious belief, religious thought, religious ideas are enforced as the law of the land and the customs of the land, and they mention that it is the religious clergy that runs the nation. And what is the religious clergy made up of? Humans. Interpreting their belief and their ideas. So it's not really theocracy where God leads. The fatal flaw in all of those forms of human government is the humans that make up that government, the humans that head them. And at the time of the end, the most powerful leaders will be personally backed by Satan and his power. And guess what? They're once again going to be motivated to make war. We're in Revelation, go to chapter 16, a couple of chapters over. Verse 12 tells us that the sixth angel poured out his bowl. Now, this is past the seals, past the trumpets, seven trumpets. The seventh trump sounds, and there are seven more plagues that are poured out before Christ's return. The sixth angel pours out its bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water is dried up, so the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits, like frogs, coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. The beast and the false prophet are two human individuals. And again, we're introduced to the dragon, to Satan. Verse 14, for they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. So all together, they're going to influence people. The dragon is going to influence the beast and the false prophet, and they will influence humans to gather an army to fight against Christ at his return. Now again, does Satan really think he's going to win this time? He fought once and lost. He fought a second time and lost. Now he thinks he's going to win when Christ returns? I mean, we see the twisted thinking. We see his twisted way of thinking. You know, one of the things that we rejoice about every year at the feast, at least I do, is hearing about how Jesus Christ is going to eliminate war. You know, I am so thrilled every time I hear somebody read those passages. Micah 4, Isaiah 2 basically say the same thing. And I dare say that somebody read one or both of those at the feast this year, no matter where you were, that they were mentioned. If not, we'll read Isaiah 4 or Isaiah 2 today. Look at what we're told. After Christ returns and sets up God's government, he wins the battle, by the way, against the beast and false prophet, against their armies. Isaiah chapter 2, beginning in verse 2. Isaiah 2:2, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house, here again the mountain, the government, God's government, is going to be established on the top of the mountains. Whatever other kingdoms there were, we have other passages in the book of Daniel that talk about this stone that demolishes all those other kingdoms, and God's kingdom is the one that rules at that time when Christ is here on earth. And shall be exalted above all the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He'll teach us of his ways, and we'll walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. See, Lucifer, as we read in Revelation 20, after Christ's return, he's going to be bound. And people will then not have that constant influence to the way of war, to the way of destruction, to the way of fighting. And they're going to want to learn God's way. They're going to see the benefits that some nations are experiencing because they are following God. And they are following his way. And they're going to want to learn that way. And verse 4, here's a beautiful passage. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. I have a screenshot, actually. It's a graphic that I'd like to display if y'all want to start getting that ready, the sound crew. You know, what a difference that's going to make when they don't fight and don't prepare for war anymore. This data is based on the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Shows that what big business war is. Notice that big part of the pie? That's the United States. That's how much we spend. And the last year that they had could gather information about accurately was the 2021. Over $2 trillion was spent worldwide. And all those different countries with all their different governmental structures were all involved in preparing for war. And the United States had the largest amount. In fact, our nation spent more than the next 9 countries combined. More than the next 9 countries, including China, India, the UK, and Russia. Now, with Russia invading Ukraine this year, and so many countries pouring billions of dollars into Ukraine's defense, and where is all that money going? I don't know if it's all accurately going into their defense. Typically, governments who come into lots of money don't always use it the way they're supposed to. I'll just say that from history. Maybe it's not the case here. But with that war going on, who knows how much more is going to be spent this year. If we spent worldwide that much last year, how much is going to be spent this year? And how much good could be done with the money that's spent on war and preparing for war? Andy Andrews' deep desire that talking about the horrors of war would keep humanity from repeating it is not coming true. It's just not happening. No human government can bring that about. The League of Nations failed after World War II. The United Nations has failed to do so also. And any future human organization or conglomeration of nations will not end war on this planet. It's going to take the government of God. And the good thing is, we know that will happen because we're promised that. To remind ourselves of a couple of things. We're here in the book of Isaiah. Let's go to chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9. These are prophetic chapters that talk about what's going to happen after Christ comes and begins to reign. Beginning in verse 6, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. It says, "For us unto us a child is born," and the translators knew this was speaking about Jesus Christ, that this was prophetic, so they capitalized the word child, capital C. "Unto us a son," capital S, "is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice, from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." Now, this passage is just rich with meaning, isn't it? I mean, it has so much to tell us. Very important concepts. Jesus Christ is going to rule. The government's going to be on his shoulders. And he's going to be called many things, including the Prince of Peace. You can take that graphic down now if you want. Including the Prince of Peace. Prince of Peace. Again, we're back to peace or war? God's way, Satan's way. He's the Prince of Peace. It's the opposite of war and fighting. He owns peace, if we want to put it that way. Because that's just the way he thinks. That's the way he is. That's his attitude. That's his inner core, is to be peaceful. And living his way brings peace. By the way, Everlasting Father is not usurping the Father's name. Again, look up the Hebrew word. Yes, it can mean a literal father, but it also means other things figuratively. There are a lot of figurative meanings. Initiator, provider, protector. There are a lot of things that Hebrew word can mean. And if we look at those other meanings of that word, Jesus Christ is the initiator, and it's through no other name under heaven can men be saved except through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. He will protect. He will provide. So it's not taking the Father's name. He's just simply being very mighty and being the protector, provider, and the initiator. And notice that the peace will continue to increase, just like his government. Now, we know the government's going to increase because during the millennium and then the white throne judgment, as people begin to learn and begin to turn to God and begin to live his way of life, they too get to be a part of his government. They too get to be a part of the family of God, just like he promises to those of us who are a part of the first fruits, who will reign with Jesus Christ, Revelation 20 tells us. They will continue to add to the family of God. Now, what happens after the white throne judgment? What happens after the new Jerusalem comes to earth and we have a new heavens and new earth? How does it continue to increase after that? I don't know. We're not told. We're not told. But as long as there is a human being who has not had a chance for salvation, God will see that that chance comes and his government will continue to increase. God's government is going to be established, or Christ's government, which is God's, will be established with righteous judgment and justice. Justice for everyone. You know, here in the United States, we talk about liberty and justice for all, and yet there really isn't justice for all. You look at some of the things that are happening in our country today where criminals are let right back out on the street to commit more crimes. People who should be given help aren't given help. People who shouldn't be given help are getting it. And there's all kinds of inequity. The leadership is going to reign. Jesus Christ and those reigning with him are going to be a different kind of leader than the governments we see today. Look at Isaiah 11, again, a couple of chapters over. Again, there's a lot in this chapter. Let's just pick it up in verse 3. We get a little bit of an idea of how Jesus Christ will reign. Verse 3, Isaiah 11:3, his delight is in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by the sight of the eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Now again, that's how he will reign, that's how he will rule. If we as the saints are supposed to rule with him, are we practicing that now? Are we trying to rule or reign whatever areas we have responsibility for? Are we trying to do that the way he's going to reign? Are we practicing that? Deciding with equity. I mean, we're not going to strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. That's something he does, and slay the wicked. Unless maybe he tells us to. But those are things in his purview. But are we looking at the way he's going to judge and say, you know, I need to be practicing that right now. Verse 5, righteousness should be the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist. Again, are we practicing living, godly discernment in our lives? You know, these are a lot of differences from human governments of today. Even the government of the United States started off with a great intent, started off with the idea that there is value in the Bible, there's value in biblical principles, but our nation's turned its back on those. Doesn't want to hear about God anymore. I won't quote you all the statistics, but there are very few people statistically in the United States who believe the Bible is literally God's word. We're becoming a non-Christian nation, which is very, very sad. And we live in a time of wars and rumors of wars, from Russia and Ukraine to China and Taiwan. Who knows when that's going to break out? Iran and Israel, who knows when the Middle East is going to blow up again. There are all kinds of things going on. Thankfully, we just concluded the Feast of Tabernacles that reminds us God's not going to let mankind destroy himself. He won't let man wipe himself off this planet. And Jesus Christ will return. And he will set up his government. And peace will exist under Christ's righteous reign. Again, since we hope to be part of that government teaching those who live in the millennium about that way to peace, it's incumbent on us to think about that, to live that, to practice that, to learn that today. We have the opportunity to do that. In fact, more than the opportunity, we have the obligation to be learning it now, to be practicing that. We're reminded of that by the Apostle James, and I'll end with this passage in James chapter 3. James contrasts two different kinds of wisdom. Human wisdom, influenced by Satan, which ends up being the way that doesn't lead to peace. It's the way that leads to fighting and war, and godly wisdom that does lead to peace. Notice how James was inspired to express this to us, to the church. James 3 and verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, there's that vanity, there's that pride, trying to get ahead and by putting others down. Do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. And where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. There's an excellent article in this new Discern magazine about leadership. And hypocrisy is one of the things that causes so many people to lose their trust in human leaders. They make rules, looking at what happened in the past couple of years, and say you have to follow these rules, and they don't follow them themselves. And there are lots of other ways that that happens as well. But it's a very good article. It talks about some of the bad characteristics of not so good leaders and good characteristics of good leaders. But James goes on to say in verse 18, says, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Make. Present, active, tense. We have to be about the business of making peace. Godly wisdom is hallmarked by being peaceable. By living as God has inspired Isaiah, James, and others to write, we can enjoy great peace now, the peace of God that surpasses all understanding, the way Paul described it. And we can practice for the world to come so that we're ready to do that. Yeah, there's a time coming when there will be no more individuals honored as war heroes like Andy. His deep desire that war will end is going to take place. Not the way he thinks it will or thought it would, but it will take place. But it will only happen when Jesus Christ makes it happen. And the saints will have the pleasure of helping teach people the way to peace. May God's government of peace come soon.